Do you want a home-cooked meal but don't have the time to run to the grocery store and buy all of the necessary ingredients? Or maybe you do, but you're not the best chef. It's okay. I won't judge. This podcast sponsor has a solution for you. It's called Home Chef, and it's quite incredible if I do say so myself. I know a lot of ads aren't really believable, but trust me when I say that I sought out Home Chef for their support, and I did it because I'm truly a fan and a customer of theirs. Home Chef delivers fresh, pre-portioned ingredients with step-by-step recipe cards right to your door. Not only do you learn how to cook an awesome meal, but you save both time and money by not having to go to the grocery store to get more ingredients than you need. And because Home Chef has agreed to sponsor this podcast, you can all now get $30 off of your first order by going to homechef.com/courtjunkie. That's homechef.com/courtjunkie. Hi, I'm Jillian, and welcome to the first Court Junkie Brief. These mini episodes are going to focus on a singular courtroom-related issue. I'll be speaking with legal experts, attorneys, analysts, etc., to really go deep and try to get a better understanding for the layperson, such as myself, about these types of issues that are crucial in our justice system. These episodes will be released in addition to my regular Court Junkie episodes. But first, as always, I want to thank all of you for your support. Those of you who listen, subscribe, leave a review, donate, I truly appreciate you, and I hope you enjoy these new mini episodes. Today's brief is about no-body cases, meaning murder cases that are tried even though a victim's body has not yet been found. There's a common misperception, and I know I've heard many people say this, that if there's no body, you can't prove that a crime occurred. You may have heard that too. They say, no body, no crime. But thankfully for those victims who might never be found, that's not accurate. Today's episode features Tad DeBise, a former federal homicide prosecutor who you may remember if you listened to episode 7 about the Alexis Murphy case. Tad is essentially an expert on these types of cases. Not only did he prosecute one himself, but he studies these cases and even consults on them. He has also authored a book on the subject called No Body Homicide Cases, a practical guide to investigating, prosecuting, and winning cases when the victim is missing. But first, I want to start this episode off by talking statistics. Tad has a website called nobodycases.com that has a ton of great info on this very topic. One of the things he tracks on his site are the number of no-body cases that have been tried in the U.S. So far, through March 5th, 2016, there have been 459 trials, and the conviction rate is a lot higher than you'd probably think. So I know you have a lot of stats on your website also that I was looking at, and how difficult would you say is it to try a murder case without a body? Like, how successful are these cases when they do go forward?
The oddity of all of this is that the conviction rate on no-body murder cases is actually quite high. It's running at about 88 or 89%. And the cases on my table are only ones that went to trial, so you're not even counting pleas. And there's a couple reasons for that. One is that most no-body murder cases, more than 50%, involve a domestic relation. Typically, husband killing wife, boyfriend killing girlfriend, boyfriend killing ex-girlfriend, killing ex-wife. And in those cases, the suspect is kind of obvious. When a woman goes missing, the most immediately suspicious person is, of course, the person who's in a relationship with her. So you start off in these cases with a little bit of an advantage as a prosecutor or as a detective, because you kind of know the pool of suspects is often relatively small. It's the boyfriend or the husband. The second reason is, in these cases, I think the cases that go to trial that are missing person cases, which all of these cases are, the cases that go to trial tend to be the strongest cases because prosecutors don't want to take difficult cases to trial because you have to prove both that the person is dead as well as that this person that we've arrested is the person who did it. So you're talking about strong cases. I've tried in my career 20 homicide cases, and the no-body case, oddly, was the strongest case of all because we had so many different types of evidence. So I think as a prosecutor, you're looking to take the strongest cases. When you look at the number of no-body cases that went to trial, though, it's an infinitesimally small proportion of murder cases that go to trial every year because there are many, many cases of missing persons, and only the strongest cases go to trial. And the other interesting statistic is that of the cases on my table, the 460-odd cases that have gone to trial, over half of them have been tried since the year 2000. So you're talking about 230, 40 cases that have been tried in the last 16 years, when some of my cases go back to the early 1800s. So there have been no-body cases, but the vast majority of cases are really being tried since 2000. And that's for two reasons. One, DNA, which of course has exploded since the early 90s in terms of its ability as a crime-solving technique. And then second, because we leave behind these electronic trails that we didn't leave behind, you know, in the 1980s and the 1990s, there was none of this. There was no social media. You weren't into the messaging. You didn't have this little phone that I'm holding in my hand. That's not a phone. It's really a supercomputer compared to some of those things in the 1990s. All of these things make it a lot easier to show that someone is indeed dead, not just testing.
I spoke to Tad about his first time prosecuting a no-body case. It was in 2006, and he was prosecuting a man accused of murdering his live-in girlfriend. The girlfriend's name was Marion Fye, and she was a 36-year-old mother of five from Washington, D.C. Prosecutors argued that Harold Austin killed her and disposed of her body in November 2003, but Marion's body had never been found. So in addition to proving that Harold killed her, Tad had to first prove that Marion was even dead. But our friend Tad was successful. A jury found Harold guilty, and he's currently sitting in prison.
When I was in prosecutor in D.C., I was transferring from being a supervisor to going what we call back to the line. So I didn't have any homicide cases assigned to me at that time, but I had been a homicide prosecutor for quite a few years in the office. And a colleague of mine who was leading the section to go to a different section came in and gave me this case that had sort of just happened and was under investigation. And it was the case of a missing woman named Marion Fye. And Marion Fye had about five kids ranging in age from 12 to about 18 years old and had been missing for several months at the time. So I got involved in the case and became very interested in it because, as I often say when I'm teaching or training on these courses, murder is the ultimate crime and a no-body murder case is the ultimate murder case. So as a prosecutor, it was a very interesting case to me because I knew these were very difficult cases. When I started researching the cases to find other cases in D.C. or throughout the country, I discovered there had only been one other case in D.C. without a body that had ever gone to trial, and that had happened back in the early 80s. So I started researching other no-body cases as well as working on my case at the same time. And basically in my case, the person who was ultimately convicted of the crime was a guy named Harold Austin, who had met Marion Fye about 2 to 3 months before her murder, and they quickly established a boyfriend-girlfriend relationship. And during this relationship, one day around Thanksgiving of 2003, they got into an argument while five kids were inside the house, three of which were Marion Fye's children, two of which were brothers who were friends with some of her children. And while these children didn't witness the murder, they were what we call ear witnesses in that they heard a single shot. And then after they had heard an argument between Marion Fye and Harold Austin, and then after that date, they never saw their mother again. Unfortunately, they had a lot of difficulties conveying what had happened to the authorities because Harold Austin stayed around after killing their mother. He sort of became a surrogate father figure for some of these kids, even though all of the kids had fathers that were actively involved in their lives. So it became very difficult for us to investigate the case because the kids were under the influence of Harold Austin. They were very afraid of him. He was a very large man, about 6'4", probably 260, 270 pounds, very intimidating. So it took a long time before we were finally able to get the kids to tell us what happened and kind of get a coherent story, because they were kids, they had a really hard time sort of describing what had happened, and their stories were sort of both internally inconsistent as well as inconsistent with each other's story. And it was only when the lead detective on the case ended up spending a lot of time with the kids and we got a child interview specialist that we really started to figure out what had happened at the case.
Did you find that you prepared for the case differently than you would have if you had actually found her body?
Definitely, because when you don't have the body, you don't have the best piece of evidence in the case. A body can tell you where the murder happened. Did it happen indoors? Did it happen outdoors? Did it happen in an alley? Did it happen in a car? The body also tells you how a murder happened. Was it poisoning, a shooting, a strangling, a blunt force trauma? And it also tells you when a murder happened. Did it happen just now? Is there a body in an alley? Did it happen a few hours ago because rigor mortis hasn't set in? Did it happen many days ago or many months ago or many years ago because we're only finding bones and a skull and those types of things? When you don't have the body, you don't have any of that evidence. You may have some evidence of a scene left behind, but there's so many things that you don't have. So I liken it as if I was a police detective and my boss came in and said, "Hey, Tad, there's been a bank robbery, but we don't know which bank." So you got to run around to a million different banks and be like, "Was your bank robbed? No. Was your bank robbed? Was your bank robbed?" And it's so difficult to solve because you don't have the best piece of evidence. The other thing I liken it to is it's like a 100-meter dash where the murderer gets to start at about the 30-meter mark. And it doesn't matter if you're Usain Bolt. If somebody is starting with a 30-meter lead in the 100-meter dash, they're going to defeat you. It doesn't matter. And that's what makes these cases so difficult. So the preparation is much more thorough, much more intensive, and most no-body murder cases are completely circumstantial cases in that you don't have an eyewitness. You only have, hopefully, forensic evidence such as DNA or blood or hair or trace evidence, something like that, or you hopefully have a confession to a friend or a family or a confession to a police. In my case, we were lucky that we ended up having all three of those things. We had forensic evidence, we had a confession to a friend, and we ultimately had a confession to the police. But most no-body murderers, you're trying to get all three or one of those three, and there's some no-body cases that you don't have any of those. So it's a very difficult case. It's a very trial-intensive case because you have to put on a lot of witnesses. You usually have to put on a lot of complicated forensic evidence, as we did in our case, because we didn't have our victim's DNA. We didn't have a sample from her. So ultimately, we had to take DNA from her mother and put that DNA on. And all that DNA told us was that blood found on a mattress in her house was a female descendant of our victim's mother. So because of that, she had had a total of five daughters, one of whom had predeceased Eve and Marion Fine, my victim. So we had to put on the other three daughters on the stand to say they had never bled in that bed. And then we were able to tie the DNA that way. So you're talking about a very labor-intensive, lots of evidence. Most no-body cases for prosecutors are the longest, most involved, and most complicated trials that they'll ever try in their career.
And then it's to even prove that a death occurred is difficult too, right? I mean, because the defense, I'm sure, could just come out and say, "Oh no, she probably ran off. Yeah, there might be some blood on the bed, but you know, she had her period, or maybe she cut her hand."
Correct.
Or something like that. So to even prove that a death occurred, I imagine, has to be pretty difficult.
Yes, because in most murder cases, all you have to prove is the guy sitting over there in the stand at the table, he's the one who did it. In a no-body case, you have two things to prove. You have to prove first that there was a murder, and second, that the guy sitting over there in the chair is the one who did it. And that can be enormously difficult because you have to prove a negative. You have to prove she's no longer alive. And for example, in my case, even back then, the use of social media and all of that was significantly lower than it was today. So we were able to prove some things, that she hadn't accessed her bank account. She had Social Security that was coming in for one of her children who were disabled. So we were able to prove she hadn't accessed that money, which she was someone who did not have a job and was kind of living day to day. And she was clearly someone who would have accessed this money if she was able to. But a lot of the other things, Facebook and instant messaging and all those things, we weren't able to prove. The defendant actually had her cell phone, so we knew where her cell phone was, and it obviously wasn't with her. And so that became very difficult to just prove that she had died. So unfortunately, what we had to do is put each of her children on the stand to testify, no, I haven't seen my mother since Thanksgiving of 2003. She missed Christmas. She missed my birthday.
Wow.
All of those things, which is very heart-wrenching for them to testify to in front of the jury, particularly in this case where the kids were quite young. You know, they were young teenagers at the time they were testifying. But that was the only way we could really prove to the jury that, no, she would not have abandoned her children. She also came, as I mentioned, from a family with three other siblings who were alive, and she was extraordinarily close to each of her sisters as well as her children, and they were each able to testify, no, we talked every week, and I haven't talked to her since Thanksgiving of 2003.
The misperception I spoke about earlier, about people oftentimes assuming that you can't prove a murder without a body, can actually affect juries too, an aspect that I hadn't really thought about before.
If you hold lay people, probably 7 out of 10 or 8 out of 10 would say, if you didn't have a body, you couldn't make the case. And that's one of the things I teach and train on, is telling prosecutors when you're selecting juries, you must have a question in there that eliminates those jurors, that says, if we prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the defendant committed the murder, can you still vote to convict even if there's no body? Because you're going to get a lot of people who say, no, I won't convict, even if you've proven it beyond a reasonable doubt. I'm not going to convict with no body. And those folks have to be eliminated from your jury. And I've also found that attitude is prevalent, unfortunately, amongst a lot of prosecutors who will not take a case if there's no body. And that was one of the reasons why I started the website now, close to probably 10 years ago, and started teaching and training, because I wanted to change that attitude amongst prosecutors. That attitude is less prevalent amongst the police, although there are some who are reluctant to go forward with a case. But it's sadly, and to me, sort of surprisingly more common amongst prosecutors who ought to know better and ought to know that there have been successful no-body cases prosecuted in all 50 states, in, you know, the Virgin Islands, in all of our territories, D.C., everywhere.
Right, right. And you brought up within jury selection, sort of making that a question to eliminate people who do not feel like they could convict without a body. Is there a way to make that a standard for these types of cases? I'm not really sure how that process works.
Yes, what I tell all prosecutors is, in the voir dire process, which is the choosing of the jury, mm-hmm. you must get that question asked. Either you ask it yourself if you're in a jurisdiction where lawyers conduct their own voir dire, or you have the judge ask it, because there certainly is enough evidence that there are many, many lay people, jurors, out there who don't believe you can convict without there being a body, that you have a right to have those people dismissed for cause, that is, without using one of your discretionary challenges called peremptory challenges. You must be able to use a for cause challenge to eliminate that person. And I have found in every jurisdiction that I've spoken to, or when I've spoken to prosecutors, they've always been able to either ask the question themselves or get the court to do it and to eliminate those people. It's a fair question, because what you're saying is, if I prove to you beyond a reasonable doubt that this guy did the murder, can you convict even with no body? And the answer under the law is clearly yes. Years ago, there used to be some states, Texas and New York, where you couldn't prove a murder case without a body, but no, there's no law in any jurisdiction anymore that says you have to have a body.
No law in any jurisdiction, you said?
No, there is no law that says you must have a body in order to prove a murder. There have been no body convictions in all 50 states.
So here's another question I had about this subject, which of course would come into my mind. Has there ever been a case where somebody was convicted of murder and the victim actually ended up being alive? Sounds like a bad Law and Order episode, or maybe a really good one, but I decided to look it up anyway. Thankfully, the only thing I've been able to find is a case from 1887, and since it's such an ancient case, I can't find any verification, literally just a Wikipedia article. But the story goes like this. A man from Marion County, Arkansas, named Charles Hudspeth, was sleeping with another man's wife when the man suddenly went missing. Charles was charged with his murder, convicted, and sentenced to death. He was supposedly executed, and then a year later, his defense attorney located the missing man, who wasn't dead after all. I think as forensic science continues to develop, these no-body murder cases will become even more common. Just this month, a high-profile case out of Michigan involved a murder without a body. The case of baby Kate, an infant who's been missing since June 2011. Baby Kate's dad, 26-year-old Sean Phillips, was just convicted of second-degree murder. And another high-profile no-body murder case, also in Michigan, has recently been in the news. Jeffrey Willis, an accused serial killer, is being charged with the murder of Jessica Haranga, who was abducted from a gas station in April 2013. That case hasn't gone to trial yet, but it will no doubt be an interesting one to follow when it does. And that's all for this Court Junkie brief on no-body murder cases. I'd love to get your feedback on this episode. Did you find it interesting? Do you like the idea of these briefs? I'd also love to know what topics you're curious about relating to our justice system. Thanks again for listening. Please consider leaving me a review if you like the show. And you can also find me on Twitter at CourtJunkiePod. You can email me at podcast@courtjunkie.com. And you can join the conversation on my Court Junkie Facebook group. It's really the cool place to be. Be on the lookout for my regular Court Junkie Episode 8, which is about a murder case that went unsolved for 23 years before the LAPD realized that one of their own just may be responsible. Thanks again.